Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. Peace. What does that mean to you? Justice. How can it be served? Truth. What is truth? These statements that I'm making with a great deal of thought. Because so often, in our world today, peace is not known. We have millions of people around this planet that do not have what we would call peace. Justice? How many times are you having conversations with people saying, I don't trust the government. I don't trust the military. I don't trust. And then, when you look at what is the truth, how do we find the truth? That is not an easy job to do. If you were in a position and you came across some information that needed to be shown and needed to be demonstrated in a way that allowed you to see what was really going on behind the scenes of whatever circumstances you might want to check into, would you be willing to dedicate yourself to put that into a positioning, being able to see? In this conversation that we are going to be having with an author, Robin R. Cutler, her publication is titled A Soul on Trial. A Soul on Trial. This is about a Marine Corps mystery that was experienced in a way that I think is unprecedented. What is the value of bringing this information forward? This time frame that we are going to be referencing, that Robin has done over 10 years of research with, is about a Marine. His name was James N. Sutton. Circumstances, 1907 is the time frame. He was, in my personal opinion, murdered. But how does a mother go up against an institution that many times in that era, and I cannot speak to this time, but in the human condition, finding out the truth, finding out the facts, is not an easy thing to do. I want to welcome to the program Robin Cutler. Robin, you have a phenomenal background. You're a historian. You've been involved in filmmaking. You also currently do a blog. When I had the opportunity to chat with you for a few minutes before beginning this interview, having gone through your book, and I have to be honest, I made through the 90% level of reading, actually reading your material, I was absolutely in awe of the research that you've done. And when you told me it took you 10 years to go into so many different resource environments, including the, you know, the back files in the National Archives, when I look at that, I go, 10 years committed to doing this kind of research. My first question to you, after welcoming you to the show, I'm so glad we are having this conversation. How did you even find out about the case? We're talking about 1907. How did you even become aware of this?
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, Donna. It's really an honor and a pleasure to have this conversation. I found out about this very unexpectedly, and I certainly didn't expect to spend so much time on this. When my mother died, she left a huge treasure trove of stuff, including documents and other objects. And one of the things I came across was a black locket that, when I opened it, had a picture of a midshipman at Annapolis and a lock of his hair. And I was very curious. I had not one clue as to what this was. And so I put it away, and the locket is, you can see pictures of it on my website as well. The locket turns out to be a mourning locket, and on the front are five little pearls, which represented, I realize now, her children. And so I put it away, but then a couple of years later, I came across a newspaper clipping, very faded and brittle, from a paper called the Los Angeles Examiner. And in that clipping, it referred to my grandmother, who had died of breast cancer when she was very young, in her 40s, as being interviewed about the fact that her mother was going to run for Congress. Now, this was 1910, and I'm thinking, run for Congress in 1910? I need to dig in here a little and see what this is really all about. She was going to run for Congress to see if anything else could be learned or more people could be mobilized to find out what really happened to her son at that point. So long story short, I got pulled into this probably primarily by the newspaper clipping. And I began to, being a historian, I began digging around in microfilm. This goes way back into the late 1990s, because now this, all this research would be much easier. But I began digging around in old newspapers in the best way you could at that point. And I suddenly discovered that this woman, who was actually my great-grandmother, was on the front pages of newspapers all across the United States, from Maine to Los Angeles and up and down the coast. And so I discovered that there were, for several weeks at first, and then later on even more, there were all kinds of newspapers covering this story. Some were traditional newspapers, like the New York Times and the Washington Post, and others were smaller newspapers. And the more I read, the more I realized, well, this is really unusual. Mm-hmm. And so then I found out that she had gone to great lengths to prove that her son, Jimmy, as he was called by the family, had not committed suicide, because the Navy, he was in a fight. I don't want to be too long-winded here, but he was in a fight, and he died at the end of this brawl with some fellow lieutenants in his Marine Corps application school. And the Navy very quickly did an investigation that happened within almost 48 hours and said it was suicide. And so she didn't believe that, and we could go into why in another mm-hmm. after another few minutes. But I just became really fascinated by the newspaper coverage and by the way the papers sort of propelled the story between 1907 and actually went on till 1910. So that's how I found the story and why I got into it. But one other aspect I should mention in answer to your question, why did it take me so long to do this? Well, after I realized that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of newspaper articles, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I went to the National Archives, and none of this could have been done without the help of a number of archivists who are fantastic. But I went to the National Archives to look at military records, which I'd never done before, and I discovered that there were a huge treasure trove of articles about all of the Marines in the training school where Jimmy had been and where he had died. And after several months there, one of the archivists, I believe it was Rick Pizer, we found this huge two-volume leather-bound set of documents related to this naval investigation that took place in 1909. And sort of that did it for me and this wonderful agent I had at the time, because this had never been studied before. So that's a really long-winded answer to your question about how I found the story. But it's how I found the story and why I stayed with it. So finding the transcript of this naval investigation where this woman in black is confronting the whole military establishment in Annapolis was just wonderful because it's quite an investigation.
Absolutely. When I started reading your material, I was very, very curious about so many things. Because when we look at, let's say, television programs today, you have all kinds of programs that started in the 60s. Actually, it went back before the 60s, even in the 30s and 40s. Murder mysteries were very, very popular with the public. And you bring out something that is so significant, and that is freedom of the press, freedom to write, to speak. And in the process of going through your book and reading all of the documentation that you had acquired, what was intriguing is that the sensationalism side of newspaper and propaganda that comes through media was known even back then. But there were those reporters. Journalism was a little bit different than today. And we're finding that there is a shift with journalism that's being revitalized, saying, don't mess with the freedom of the press. You cannot. This is something that we have to preserve. We don't want censoring, and we need the freedom of the press. And this is something that we're dealing with right now, today. And the newspapers at the time were one of the primary forms of communication in the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s. And of course, now today we have the internet. We have a whole different world, and we get engaged with what is the truth, how do we know the truth, and you have all kinds of information that's put out there, which is extraordinarily frustrating to a lot of people. In this time frame, those reporters were allowed into, you know, the public hearings and the various environments. This is very, very powerfully dramatic, but also very insightful into how things have to be looked at from actually different angles. And that's what you've done. You have, in this book, taken a real case that is very much, I think, in a parallel positioning with what we are facing today with who can I trust? Who can I believe? What are the facts? What's going on in the courtroom? And I think some people, you know, when you look at how those television programs evolved, you know, as filmmaking became something that was enabling information to get out to people, even though it might be in a fictitious format, you graduated into Perry Mason in the 60s and the 70s. You had all of these different evolutions. And to this day, people are still fascinated with court cases and with environments. And we, you know, we're not going to go into that. But here we are. And again, to me, what is a parallel situation of how do we get representation by government that is with integrity, and also representation by people that are in positions of authority, regardless of what level they're in, and how do you get to the truth? And when I was reading your book and I saw how things were done, and forensic medicine today is so different from what was done then, this is an incredible read into how important this case was, not just for the aspect of murder, but also the courage of your relative in a court of law that looked at women as if they were nincompoops, and what she endured. This is just an incredible read. When you were going through this and you started off, you didn't have any idea you were going to be doing this kind of a publication, did you?
Not at all. No, I just got more and more pulled in by the different rabbit holes this took me to, because I was not, my field was not military justice, although I was interested in legal history, and my field was certainly not the paranormal, which is another aspect of the story, because this mother was convinced that she saw visions of her son, who told her, in her mind anyway, he told her what happened before she had any other way of knowing that. And that's another conversation or part of this conversation. But I did not have any idea I was going to spend so long on this. But I kept getting pulled into the whole question that you just raised, which is how do we know the truth when there are so many different versions of it coming out in the Navy investigations, in the preliminary one in 1907, and then Rosa had to fight very hard using pen and paper and three or four men who were incredibly helpful to her to get the Navy to reopen a second investigation, which became a national sensation. And there's where I think it's the newspapers from that era, and it was an era when newspapers were really coming into their own. It was the progressive era in mm-hmm. American history. The newspapers really took on this story and took on her cause. And one of the key threads in the book is that by blasting her story all across the country in these papers, which is interesting because at that time in our history, newspapers came out three or four times a day, not just once a day. And so people would be, the era of paperboys when we see them in movies, you know, they're yelling mm-hmm. the story, you know, come by this, and it happened in the morning, the afternoon, the evening papers. And so she started a national conversation about finding the truth, which you mentioned earlier. And what was happening, and we're very aware of this now in a different way, but what was happening is the papers began to shape the public dialogue and public opinion. And so people began to sit around and chat in their saloons and parlors and kitchen tables about, you know, what did happen to this boy? And did this woman really see his ghost? And this is really odd. And so a lot of the newspapers did a really good job, not just with editorials and investigative reporting for that era, but with reporting the facts as they found out the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I think finding out the truth is what Americans were trying to do for a couple of years over this story. So
yes.
We'll see. The reader has to kind of make up their mind. The book is a bit long because I was new to this and I was trying to really take a look at who the people were, who are the characters in this story, and what do we need to know about them to figure out whether they're telling the truth or not. That's another aspect of it.
That is a huge aspect of it all. And who's trying to cover up what because they just want it to disappear? We're just going to stuff it underneath the rug, as the old saying goes. Put it under the rug, but eventually, now here we are in 2026. You're doing research on a legal case that occurred in 1907. Now the mother, and this is very important, the mother and the son had a very powerful connection. And my background and my personal experience deals often with the paranormal. And in our world today, this is something quantum science is recognizing, and telepathy, all kinds of different experiences people can have that for so many generations often were just laughed at, and people sometimes were even put in mental hospitals because they had the skills of mind that nobody wanted to acknowledge because it was an unknown. They didn't have a language for it. They didn't know how to understand it. But when I was reading about Rosa, I would say in my world today, and in the world that I have known relative to the paranormal, she was a medium. And all that means is that she had the capability of getting information. And her son, after his death, appears to her like in a hologram. I'll use that as an example. It's like a hologram. And he appears to her and he's telling her, I was murdered. And he's giving information to her. And when she gets the information about his death, now she was known in the family. People did not know what to do with that in the family. She would say, well, such and such is going to occur, and things would happen. And it was as if she was reading information, and that's why so often sessions are called readings. They're reading information that is coming to her specifically. Well, the bond between her and her children, extraordinarily strong, and women are known for this. And I've talked to many women that have had very powerful experiences. And one of the things you bring out is that in the courtroom, more women were attending because they related to Rosa. They knew about experiences like this. Maybe they didn't know how to put it into words. Spiritualism was something that had evolved in the 1800s. It had come into the United States. It had long been known in ancient cultures in Europe. All of this is documented. It is a fact. It is not woo-woo. So here we have this woman that is willing to stand up for her son and saying, this is not right. My son told me He was murdered. And she begins taking this to the legal aspect, saying, this is not my son. My son did not commit suicide. And also the fact that she was Catholic. And what drove her, because this wasn't something she had planned to do, what drove her to do this is because of a particular aspect of positioning relative to suicide by the Catholic Church. And she was not going to have her son given a label of suicide. Let's go into that for just a moment, because this is a very powerful part of this story and the significance of it being made public. She didn't stand down. She stood her in her cause. And Emmanuel, your relative was an incredible human being.
Well, Rosa, just to backtrack here a little bit, Rosa Brandt Sutton was the seventh of 12 children in a pioneer family. Her parents had come east from Ohio to Washington State, and her father died when she was about 12. But she was raised by nuns, not raised exactly, but educated by nuns, along with her sisters, up near Vancouver, Washington. And when she was a little girl, she was taught the Catholic religion. I mean, she became Catholic, and she was taught the catechism and several basic tenets of Catholicism. And one of the most important things that she learned as a little girl was that nothing's more important than your immortal soul, and that, among other things, if you commit suicide, you will lose your chance to be joined with God and get to heaven. So she firmly believed that in the afterlife, you're reunited with your loved ones. And one of the things that was devastating when she heard from the Navy, or her husband heard, and they all heard that he had committed suicide, was devastating to think, because we have to also remember this boy was Catholic too, that not only would he be going to hell, he could not be buried in a consecrated grave, which becomes part of the story too. And Jimmy would never be able to, or his soul, they would never be able to be reunited after she died. In the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
So there was all that motivating her in the beginning. And that in the beginning, that became the main thrust of her crusade to find out what happened, especially since he told her several things, supposedly in this vision, that turned out to be accurate. Now, not everything she came up with initially was accurate when she was writing and trying to find out what happened to Jimmy. But several things were very puzzling. And this had happened to her before in her life, where she had heard that her mother died from her mother before anybody else knew, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rosa had these anxiety-producing sort of paranormal experiences, as you put it, mediumistic in a way. But the other thing that, as I mentioned in the book, that's really important, is that the Catholic Church frowned on all this. It was anathema to them that you would try to be communicating with the dead without the whole church way of helping you through priests and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So Rosa started a crusade to find out what happened to Jimmy, and there were several witnesses who testified. This came up later on, but who testified that she really did have these visions. So I think that one of the tensions in the book is her absolute conviction that Jimmy was talking to her, and the fact that the church would have frowned on that. But she plunges on ahead anyway.
Yes, she does. In fact, you mentioned James Cardinal Gibbons. It was the highest official in the American Catholic Church, and James Hervey Hyslop, America's foremost psychical researcher. So here, right. You know, you bring up these details that create an environment that is the precursor to a lot of what's understood today. And there's always going to be skeptics until someone themselves have, you know, personal experiences. But your family member said, my son did not commit suicide, and the case begins. And you found also in your research in 1996 that there was a comment that was made that Lieutenant Sutton's death, her son, Rosa's son, had threatened to develop into a Dreyfus case in America. And it was a difficult process. It was a slow-moving process with all the information you found. And you ended up finding a full transcript of the naval inquiry into the cause of his death, as you mentioned earlier. It had been misfiled. So who hasn't had that experience? Goodness gracious, it's so easy to misfile something. We have that challenge even today. And yet, here you have all of this intriguing process that you've documented. Takes 10 years for you to do this. And one of the drivers that is very much behind your writing, and it's very obvious as you are detailing things out, that how important it is for we as citizens to understand the value of the freedom of the press and not having censure of materials. Someone saying, well, we're going to wipe this out because we don't want you to know about it. It's not important to you. Just ignore it. No, that's not the case. We have to look at the good, the bad, and the ugly with an open mind, open attitude, so we can get to the truth. And I like to think that in this country, that's what we are doing little by little. You talk about the directives from the Department of Defense, and this is something that's going on today, that so many things disappear or hidden. Often they are not destroyed, but they are hidden. We had the situation in American history with J. Edgar Hoover, but coming back to your material, this is so powerful in demonstrating how these human patternings, they never really go away, do they?
No, well, certain aspects of human nature seem to take a stronger hold on the American government and psyche at different times than other times. Those are the less appealing aspects of human nature, which we're dealing with now. Okay, going back to what you were talking about earlier, there were several men who helped Rosa in the end solve her dilemma of, was she crazy? People accused her of being crazy and poisoning the land with false stories and hallucinating and all these kinds of things. That was going to be one of the Navy's big points to mobilize people against her, or at least get their own court, the three men on the Naval Court, to vote the way they did. But two of the men who helped her the most in the end were James Cardinal Gibbons, who was at that point the only American cardinal, who ended up believing her story, and then James Hervey Hyslop, who provided a lot of material for parts of the book, because Hyslop was one of the foremost psychical researchers in America in the early 20th century. And what he did was organize a very comprehensive study of Rosa and her family, and that includes her husband, and she had three daughters and two sons. And so what he did is Rosa and her family were from Oregon. The Suttons lived in Oregon, in Portland. And so he had a colleague named George Thacker, and Thacker spent two or three months, almost every day, with the Sutton family, talking to Rosa and talking to her daughters and husband, and he pulled together written testimony from 14 witnesses to put together some kind of proof that she really did see visions of her son, and examine how she could have known certain things about the night he died before anybody else told her. So there was that aspect of the story that became really fascinating. And then going into that a little more, for example, one of the things that impressed Jimmy's father a lot and several other people was Rosa said that Jimmy told her his watch had been smashed and his shoulder knot was missing, and he'd been beaten up a certain way. And when her daughter, and this is the one person in the family in this story that I actually knew in person, her daughter Rose, her oldest daughter, went to Annapolis, and her goal was, she went all the way across the country on a train with the goal of, I was going to say bringing Jimmy's body home, but that was one of the dilemmas the family had. Jimmy could not be buried in a Catholic cemetery because he was supposedly a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So Rose Parker, who was then married, that was her married name, Rose went all the way to Annapolis, interviewed several of the Marines who had been involved in Jimmy's death, and that was kind of fascinating in itself because she's a single woman, a pretty attractive single woman in her late 20s, and she just decided to take on the case for the sake of her mother and father. And she arranged to have his body buried in Arlington Cemetery through a friend in New York. And so, Rose, when I was... I didn't get into this story because of a family connection, because as a historian, what pulled me in were the sources, the incredible documents that I found that nobody had seen before, and the newspaper coverage. But it was interesting to get to know Rose as a younger woman, because when I knew her, she was sort of my surrogate grandmother, and she was paralyzed. She was in a wheelchair for part of that time, but still mischievous and strong-minded. And I digress here, but anyway. Rose found out information, and by the time she came back, because there's no telephoning going on or anything like we are so familiar with now, you can text, oh, Mom, I talked to this soldier, and he told me this and that and the other thing. None of that. We have such a different media environment right now.
Mm-hmm.
But she went all the way back on the train, and when she got there with Jimmy's trunks, and they opened Jimmy's trunks, they found that there was this watch that was smashed, and there was this jacket without the shoulder knot, which somebody had pulled off probably in one of the fights he got into in the very end of his life. So I just found it interesting that Rosa, I think, was very conflicted sometimes about these visions she thought she saw,
or mm-hmm.
she was actually quite definite about it, that she was convinced she saw of Jimmy because of the way her church felt about it.
In your book, you, as you are giving the information, you have photographs, you have pictures of the letters that you found, which when we talk about and use an old saying of there's red tape, you actually found letters that were wrapped in red tape that had been a part of the trial itself, which is amazing that they're still available. This is why I think today people are so interested in their own family legacy, which is what you have gone through, and to be able to realize that because people wrote things down, those papers.
This is so important. I feel quite passionate about this particular topic because the National Archives and Records Administration in Washington, D.C., along with so many organizations in Washington, D.C., is under great duress right now because the funding has shrunk, and it's extraordinary the amount of records they have for our military, all branches of the armed services.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea about this 20 years ago. And so when I went into the archives, I was looking for any information I could find out about the men who were involved, about Jimmy, for one thing, and his military service, and also about the other men who had been at the Naval Academy with him and who then were in this small Marine Corps application school, it was called. It's the precursor of Quantico, which most people listening might have heard of,
mm-hmm.
where the Marines are trained today. And so I found documents that were, it was just amazing to open up the folders and find them still wrapped up. It's a cloth tape, the red tape. It sort of faded a little bit, but it was definitely red tape. I found letters and the files these men filled out when they were applying for the Marines, the letters of recommendation that they had, because remember, most of the people going to the service academies were going to be officers. I was not dealing with so many enlisted men in this story, but mostly people who are going to be commissioned officers.
Mm-hmm.
So they have all these files, and then when we found that it's two volumes, it's now been bound in leather, but the trial transcript, it was so critical to find, and there probably wouldn't be a book without it, actually, because that's where so much comes out that is sort of fascinating about the year 1909 and how people were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So the trial transcript is close to 1,500 pages long.
Wow.
And it's long legal sheets, not even 8 by 11, but 8 by 14. And attached to it, and I used to get so excited about this kind of thing, are several exhibits. And among the exhibits were these black bordered letters, which Rosa had written to a Marine Corps payroll clerk that she thought was going to be her friend. And he apparently misled her in the beginning by saying he was her friend. She thought that he was somebody her son had known. And so it was just wonderful to find them. They had been sealed, some of them with sealing wax, which people used to use. And they had, there's a picture on the back of the book of this, actually. And in these letters, written in 1908, Rosa bares her soul literally in the most passionate way about what she thought happened to her son. And some of it was right on target, and other parts were emotionally inspired thoughts that the Marines had been out to kill him, and it was a conspiracy to beat him up, when that actually turned out to be not true. But part of that was inspired by the fact that Jimmy was a little out of place in this Marine application school, and in some ways at the Naval Academy too, because both her sons were incredibly strong, physically strong. And she had two sons, Jimmy and his younger brother, Don, who was actually at West Point when this was going on in Annapolis. And so they were from Oregon. Jimmy was from Oregon and not particularly tall. And he had been maybe a little unpopular at the Naval Academy, not among civilians. He was apparently very popular. But at the Naval Academy, he was very much against hazing, which mm-hmm. was a big issue back in the turn of the 20th century, because it was pretty brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was strong enough to fight well, and usually the military code of behavior was very... Well, hard to take, actually. Lots of young men, some of them as young as 16, who started in the Naval Academy, didn't make it. They left. As many as 80 in his class who didn't make it, because they found the environment quite brutal back then. And so, in any case, Jimmy had made a best friend there, but he also had made a couple of the other Naval Academy cadets annoyed. And one of them ended up in the Marine Application School with him. He's the one who immediately said that Jimmy committed suicide, a young man from Illinois named Harold Utley. And so there were 12 of these young men in this Marine Corps Application School, which mm-hmm. is across the creek from the Naval Academy. This is when Jim, just setting the scene from before.
One
from the moments before Jimmy died. And so
right.
I found, going back to the document, that I could get to know all of these men. I was sort of living with these Marines and where they came from and how they got into the Marines and what some of their medical problems were. So that's sort of a plug for all of the information you can find out about Americans 100 years ago and even way before that in the National Archives.
I think that is very, very important. In today's world, the information about American history often is dumbed down. And I think that one of the gifts that your book brings is an awareness that the dumbing down needs to be brought out and faced. We don't dumb down things. We must have the facts. And in many respects, in today's world, journalism, as it should be respected, is not. And this is why
absolutely.
This is why many younger people that are getting into journalism need to know about early American history and how important it is to have the facts. And there will always be those people that are going to say, no, you don't have my permission to do this. But those facts are important. And that's something that you bring out very, very well in the book, in so many different levels of what was going on. You know, people will watch Law and Order and they say, oh, well, that's great. In 60 minutes, everything's fixed or it's not fixed. And there's all these dynamics that go on. But this was a case that the mother, for not just 6 months or for an hour, if you will, it's not that way. This took a few years, and eventually there was a resolution. It wasn't 100% of what needed to be talked about, but it was there. One of the aspects that I found extremely interesting was the doctor, the forensic specialist, that actually proved that Jimmy could not have committed suicide, demonstrated it in a court of law. And yet all of that was just totally ignored. There is so much in this book that you have written, you know, that a soul on trial, because Rosa was mocked. That was going to be directed against her is that this is a hysterical woman. She's going to discredit the military. But the women that were associated with the military in the environment that she had to put herself into, a lot of them were very, very nasty to her, very upset because their husbands, their sons, their brothers, uncles, nephews were in the military. And they say, you can't do this to my men. This is not right. You're wrong. You're nuts. You're crazy. But she held true. And the reality was that she did something that was so important. And those that stood beside her saying, justice has to be served. The American people, because of what was put out, because of what was there, began to question what is really going on behind the scenes. And there was that exposure, if you will. And there is a statement by Jimmy at the end of the book, and I'm not going to mention that, because to read the story, to really go through all of your material, shows how important Rose's experiences were. And she was not going to give up because her son was not going to be condemned in a way by her own church and by other people. No, the truth had to come out. And there are so many aspects to this that when one is reading it, they have to be able to read it to understand this was a case that had to go on and had to be reopened. And there were a lot of things that the people in authority, this is the time during Taft and also Teddy Roosevelt being in the positioning, where is the integrity? Where is the honesty? That is really what she was questioning, because what she knew and what her experience had been with these paranormal happenings with her son, and there was a series of them even after certain things were settled. But she was determined to be able to dig up and dig out facts. And that actually happened in the courtroom. And this wasn't supposed to be a courtroom spectacle. But holy Moses, it really did become one, didn't it?
Well, I think that one of the things I found most sort of fun in a way about this sort of tragic story is that the protagonists, and there's, in a way there's two, Rosa and this judge advocate, Harry Leonard, who was a combat hero from the, he became sort of her nemesis. And he was running the inquiry. And there were three members of the court. And then there was Harry Leonard. And he had a whole plan that this naval inquiry would put Rosa on the spot, because what happened here, and I mentioned these letters before, is that unbeknownst to Rosa or her attorney, these supposed secret letters she had poured her heart out in, sent to this Swartz, he got hold of these letters, because obviously Rosa was betrayed by this man she thought was a friend. And so what happened during this naval inquiry, which is an investigation simply to find out the facts, is it turned into a trial, in quotes, in effect, because Leonard was able to make Rosa, by reading these letters out loud to the American public and to the court, he was able to make Rosa clearly a sort of prosecutrix and her lawyer a prosecutor, and all of the men involved in Jimmy's death or in the brawl were, then became defendants. So this changed the way the courtroom dynamics went on in the end. But you mentioned something earlier about Dr. Schaefer. The Suttons did bring in this Dr. Edward Schaefer, who brought two skulls and some knitting needle-like probes and some wax into the courtroom to prove that the projectile of the bullet in Jimmy's brain could not have been made by somebody with their face down in the ground. When the bullet went into Jimmy's head, he was face down on the ground with three men on top of him. And the claim was that he pulled his arm out from under him and somehow shot himself in the head. And there were several very interesting antics in the courtroom to try to prove that he could have done this. And then Dr. Schaefer was able to demonstrate that it wouldn't have been possible. And it got very entertaining because at one point he had one of the Marines lie down on the floor and try to shoot himself in the head to demonstrate to the courtroom that it could have been done. And it turned out the only way the guy could do it was to use his thumb. And even then, it wasn't exactly the way the bullet, he could not have shot the bullet the way it really was in his brain. So I think it was very interesting to go through this entire transcript and to see how the inquiry progressed. And another thing that was very much worth reading are the closing arguments of the two lawyers, Rosa's lawyer, Henry Davis, and Arthur Burney, who became the lawyer for all the Marines, the four or five Marines defendants. In the closing arguments, as you mentioned, Davis pointed out all of the inconsistencies in the testimony and all the reasons why it was clear that Sutton did not kill himself. And then Burney gets on the stand and doesn't even speak for nearly as long as his brother lawyer, Davis. And Arthur Burney tries to make a mockery of Rosa. Uh-huh. And uses they both use wonderful language from that era, drawing on the classics and things like that, which was kind of fun to read. But Burney goes into a real speech about how Rosa is hallucinating. She's poisoned the land. Public opinion comes up constantly during this trial that the Suttons have poisoned the land with these lies, and they're all generated by a woman who is hallucinating. And he really made fun of her. And one of the speeches he made that was most interesting to read was how he compares the honor of the Marines sitting there in the courtroom who've been accused by this hallucinating woman to that she's staining their honor the way a woman's honor is stained. And it's just the language is quite eloquent, and it's worth reading. It's just worth reading their closing argument, because in the end, Rosa does achieve a certain kind of redemption for mm-hmm. herself and for her dead son, who she also, after this whole courtroom procedure is over, as we know, she's able, with all kinds of political maneuvers, to get his body dug up in Arlington Cemetery. And that in itself is quite a scene. And another autopsy is provided. And so that was kind of fascinating to read about, and I had to have a medical examiner look at the documents and those kind of things. But Rosa does achieve one of the main goals of her original crusade, and that is she gets her son buried in a consecrated grave by a Catholic priest,
mm-hmm.
thanks to Cardinal Gibbons.
Mm-hmm. The story is so powerful, but in your epilogue, in your book, you say 1901 changes in America society had inspired more and more women to participate in government, lobby their representatives, and use the only medium easily available, newspapers, to express outrage against real or perceived injustice. Now, this is a time in history where women discovered and were willing to fight for their rights and to stand up and speak out, which was just absolutely, in the man's world, appalling. This was something the women were, again, hysterical. All of these terms that were used in that time frame, women in a court of law rarely had an opportunity financially, one, to be able to afford it, and two, to really be taken seriously. If they didn't have men standing beside them or behind them, like Rosa had, then they were just washed away. And that's a very sad part of American history. It's a part of human history because it still exists in many different cultures. And I have heard women say today that we have gone backwards. So in reading your book, A Soul on Trial, and looking at where we are today, when you were writing this, you had no idea that you were going to go down the rabbit holes, and I use plural because you found a number of them, that you never imagined that you would in any way investigate, but you did. Upon completion of this particular book, how did this change or affect your perceptions of where we are today in our own political environment of, quote, false news, rhetoric, all of what we are hearing, and people are just so overwhelmed they don't even want to watch the news anymore? How did this research on your family member make a difference in your thinking and how you look at our world today?
I think following Rosa's story, and also in part the stories of some other mothers who lost their sons, in this case in the Army, and were not told the truth about what happened to them, I think what I see is some parallels to what's happening today, although in the last 2 or 3 years especially, I think that doing all this work on something that happened over 120 years ago made me appreciate how important it is to let the media, and in that case, 100 years ago, it was just the newspapers, and now it's a whole huge different ecosystem of all kinds of ways mothers can reach out and find help from newspapers, but not just newspapers, social media, and so forth. How did it affect how I see today? Well, I'm very concerned about what's going on now in terms of our First Amendment and in terms of the rights that Rosa felt she had, partly because of what was going around her and her world in the progressive era when women were really mobilizing to try to get to vote and so forth. So today, we're losing. I think we're going backwards, and it really concerns me because we're losing the freedom of the press in a way that wasn't the case back then. The freedom of the press is what got her into a courtroom in Annapolis for the entire country to weigh in on. And now public opinion is being threatened in certain areas by certain attempts to control what we're hearing on the news.
Mm-hmm.
People are critical of the government or the Department of Defense, the Secretary of Defense, or the president, and then they're insulted and they're discouraged on so many levels from giving negative criticism. Of course, when you're in the military, part of the code of justice is that you're not supposed to criticize your superiors. So when you're, even if you're an officer in the military, you're not technically supposed to criticize. Let's take an example here, the Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's happening right now is, as we saw when reporters were kicked out of the Pentagon, there's been a very concerted effort to quash public opinion and quash criticism of the military. And I feel that because so many people are being dismissed from the military, or, for example, the first woman ever to run the Naval Academy, a superintendent, was fired for no reason after a year, and somebody else put in there. I think we're in the freedoms that Rosa grabbed onto to make her case are under great threat right now. And everything now is on a different scale. There's thousands more ways you can communicate to the public through the internet and so forth. But back then, you didn't have the kinds of threats to freedom of speech and freedom of the press that we're dealing with right now, I would say. So
I really think what you're saying.
More aware of it.
Mm-hmm. I really think what you're saying is very, very true. In fact, if I recall correctly, there is a young man in the military. I do not remember his rank or positioning that was arrested because he was vocally criticizing publicly certain actions on the part of government. And he was very open, not hiding anything, but expressing his opinion. And instead of saying, let's look at what's going on. Does he have justification for it? But that is against military ruling, as you have just stated. So we are in a very significant period of American history, and it's not the only time that this has happened. But it is a time where I think that as a nation, we need to be alert, aware, and open-minded and saying, let's get at the truth. No hiding stuff under the rug. And your book, A Soul on Trial, is very much a demonstration of that. Even though it's 120 years after the fact, it's valuable saying, pay attention to what's going on today, because it does make a difference. Now, your website, which has links to the book, and it's got all kinds of historical documentation, letters, everything else that people, if they're curious about this, are curious about this case that occurred in the early 1900s and want to read the dynamic story in a way, believe me, it's just absolutely gripping, then you go to your website, and it's Robin R. Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, Robin R. Cutler. CUTLER.com. Robin, I want to thank you very much for being my guest. I am just in awe of what your 10 years of work has produced. And I would just say to my audience at this moment, don't be afraid to read. Pick up a book and read. Pay attention to what is going on. There are a lot of good people, just like Robin, that are saying, please pay attention to what's happening in the nation itself. It is time to be aware that there are things being done that should not be put away in a file somewhere for another 120 years before the truth is found out. Robin, thank you again for being my guest.
Oh, it was a great pleasure, and thank you. And I know I'm a bit long-winded sometimes, but I'm trying to focus in on what you just said. It's so important. There are books being taken out of libraries. There was a speaker at West Point who was canceled because he might say the wrong thing. And this is just happening on such a huge scale right now that we need to be aware. And most of all, we need to vote. So I think that's hopefully what will happen before too long.
Thank you again for being my guest, Robin. Before I say goodbye, I would like to share with you a thought by Bill Moyers. And it comes from the programming Life on the Plantation. This is the moment freedom brings. The moment you realize someone else has been writing your story, and it's time you took the pen from his hand and start writing it yourself. Bill Moyers.
This is Donna Sebo. Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.